Good evening and welcome to the Pan-African Connection Hour. I'm Okwesi Tahimba, owner of the Pan-African Connection Bookstore and Resource Center, an organizer with the United States of Africa Revolutionary Party. And also we have on the line with us my co-host, Kaleika Baruti. How are you doing, Kaleika?
I'm doing pretty good. Good evening, everybody.
Good, good. And we also have with us this evening another host, co-host this evening will be with us, who is Chuck Seiler. He's a historian and writer and artist and many other things. How you doing, Chuck?
I'm good, Equita.
Okay, great, great. And we're going, let me just, like I always like to do, let me just give thanks to our ancestors and for all of their sacrifices they've made for us so that we could be here today continuing their work. They passed the baton to us, and we have no choice. It is our historical responsibility to take it and fly with it. So, Kaleika, did you want to open up with a quote this evening?
Yes, this quote is in regards to May Day. Tomorrow is May 1st. And we view May 1st internationally as a day to recognize workers' rights, and not only that, but just to more so to utilize it, as I know we do as an organization. We utilize, you know, ignite a fire in the people that will have them, you know, uphold their principles and protect their rights as workers. You know, it's an ongoing thing that we must do. You know, we must always, you know, safeguard our interests. And so looking at these dates historically and you know, commemorating them is not just so much of a feel-good situation. It's something that's completely necessary. So I want to open with a quote that helps remind us of that. And this quote reads, "Let the winds lift your banners from far lands with a message of strife and of hope. Raise the maypole aloft with its garlands that gathers your cause in its scope. Stand fast, then, O workers, your ground. Together, pull strong and united, link your hands like a chain the world round, if you will that your hopes be requited. When the world's workers, sisters and brothers, shall build in the new coming years a layer house of life, not for others, for the earth and its fullness is theirs." I think that the last sentence of that quote is very significant because it challenges the reality of our labor situations, you know, with big corporations and so forth. You know, a lot of times we are subjected to work and we don't enjoy the fruit of our labor, and many others enjoy the fruit in magnitude and what we get, you know, little or nothing. So I think that this quote was actually written in 1894, and it still holds significance today, in my opinion.
Yep. Yeah, International Workers' Day is very important. Tonight we have on with us Brother William Cox, who is an organizer with the UFCW and a campaign called Our Walmart. And this is a campaign, I mean, I think Walmart is the largest employer within the United States, maybe in the world, I don't know. But I know that they are the largest employer of workers within the United States. And they have a lot of issues. Walmart is not the fairest employer. But William, tell us a little bit about some of the campaigns and actions that are taking place with some of the workers trying to make their working conditions better.
Well, first I want to say good evening to everybody and thank you for having me. What our Walmart is an association that was created by some Walmart associates in Law, Maryland, and it branched out across the country. And so locally here, they have Walmart associates that have made the decision to stand up and live better. They feel that they work for an employer that can provide more for them, and they are using their voice to ask for more.
So
some of the things that's been going on locally and across the country, I know a lot of people may have seen things in the media circling around our Black Friday. That was a very critical point for Walmart associates because themselves as well as supporters took over 1,000 nonviolent actions across the country. And this took place even in cities in Alaska. So this was across the country. So it was a big, big moment in time, and luckily the media was able to capture it. So that did give a broader stroke of audience to see the message. But now it's kind of time that we got to drive this home in our community. So those actions that she's talking about are things that we need to just be doing to be more conscious and more aware. And that's kind of my purpose for really, really wanting to be on this call tonight, because it is to put that call out to the community to say, you know, what can we do to support the Walmart associates more so than waiting on there to be an action?
I read somewhere online where there, the California Walmart workers did go on strike. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, there were some Walmart warehouse workers that made the decision that they were going to go on strike, but not only did they go on strike, they made the decision that they were going to do sort of a pilgrimage. So when they got off strike, they decided to take a 50-mile walk. And what they did was kind of, they were the ones that kind of sparked that whole Black Friday thing. They were one of the main ones that kicked it off. And they did it in such a big way that it caused ripples across the country. There were places where they were one worker that walked off the job just because they saw what those warehouse workers did in California when they made the decision to walk off.
What are the ongoing plans? Do you have anything immediately planned for action?
Well, they are... The associates locally are in the works of planning something in the near future. They haven't set a date, but they are in the next week going to have a date set. But
when you say locally,
locally, I mean for any area of the country, there's going to be things going on in Dallas and California and Maryland.
Right.
So it's going to be various parts of the country. And also, while we're speaking of that, if you go to forrespect.org and you click the Get Involved link and you give an email address and what area you're in, they can have somebody locally in that area contact you or somebody close to the area contact you about events and different things that are going on. So that's forrespect.org.
So I was reading one quote from a Walmart worker, and he said that all they're asking for is respect, right? He says, I've never been a slave, but I don't like this. It's out of control. This is about freedom. It's about rights. And why should Walmart take their rights away? So, you know, all workers, you know, regardless if it's a sanitation worker, there was a campaign here where we were organizing this, helping the sanitation, Dallas sanitation workers, you know, get a living wage and better working conditions and health care, and, you know, because they weren't getting that. As large as the city of Dallas is, they had the lowest paid, we have the lowest paid sanitation workers in the country. I mean, you have little cities like Longview next to us that have those sanitation workers are paid more than the Dallas sanitation workers. So, you know, all workers should get a decent living wage and be treated with dignity on the job. So, you know, tell us, what are some of the conditions that's what are some of the complaints, I guess, some of the workers are saying? Is it just that Walmart could pay them more, but they don't? I mean, they pay them, are they paid minimum wage, or what? Tell us some of the conditions.
Well, the employees do make more than minimum wage. They do come in about around the $9 range, which we all know that's not a lot of money in this economy. But what their main
taxes.
Exactly. But what their main focus has actually been the respect issue, because all those things you listed, you know, if you paid somebody a living wage, that's a form of showing them respect. If you provided them with affordable health care, that's a form of showing someone respect. So they've been really just trying to drive home that issue that if you respected me as an associate, if you respected me as an employee, then you would give me all of these things because you see how hard I work to make sure that your profits continue to go through the roof. You know, we're talking about the Walmart workers who make on an average of $9, but in 2012, the CEO made $20 million. So it's a large, large gap between those that are doing the work and those that are profiting from the work.
You know, a lot of times when you have, like, certain movements on the ground, you know, there's an opposition or it's called forces as such. You know, these are big structures that we're dealing with. And a lot of people who do work at Walmart, you know, they may be paycheck to paycheck, you know, or just trying to get the basic necessities that they need in life. And a lot of times, because of it, because it's so necessary for them to eat, they don't call out these elements and these forces, you know, like you said, the respect question. They don't really contend with these powers because they lack power. And so a lot of times they are intimidated for fear of losing their jobs. So I want to ask, like, what type of response have you been getting from the people that are in these situations? Is it easy to rally the people, or is it a struggle?
It's fear. It is flat-out fear because they live in the situation every day. They go through it on a daily basis. But when you try to speak with someone about it, they just have this fear that you see in them. It grips them, and they just are not willing to speak up. But you do have those ones in the group that are willing to take that step forward. And so it's good because you have those ones that are willing to step forward, and they bring those ones along with them. That's why they do it as a group. That's why it's so important for them to have their moments of bonding and getting to hear each other's stories. But it's also very important for us as a community because I use the word community, but Walmart sees a consumer. And every single consumer that goes in that store knows a Walmart associate, is the son of a Walmart associate, the cousin, the mother, the daughter of a Walmart associate. So we see what they go through. We see firsthand what they go through because we live next door to them. We live in the house with them. So we know what goes on. You know, why can't we speak for them? Nothing's going to happen to us. You know, so why can't we give them that boost to say, you know what, I understand the situation you're in. I know that you could say something that could possibly lose that check that you have to have in your household, so I'm going to speak for you. I'm going to speak up for you.
Once we had received a letter from a lady that worked at Walmart. She mailed it to the Pet African Connection, and she was complaining. Well, actually, it was her daughter who wrote the letter to us, asking us to help her organize some type of campaign. Her mother was disrespected so bad on the job, right? And this was the daughter who was feeling her mother's pain because her mother couldn't quit the job, but she was treated so inhumanly on the job, but she couldn't quit. But her daughter was trying to let people know what was going on with her. This was a young child, a teenager or so, writing a letter to the community, to us, to let us know that the conditions that her mother was working under were horrible. So I think it not only affects the the associate or the person working on the job, but their children, you know, they feel the effects of this exploitation, right, and oppression, I think. So, you know, it not only affects the associate, but like you say, it affects the community because we all know somebody worked for Walmart. And most of the one, some Walmart will hire people that some jobs won't hire. They'll hire high school dropouts. They'll hire some people with felonies. But then you're put under such conditions to where, like you say, you can't speak out. And then most people there, they really can't afford to work there because Walmart not paying them a full 40-hour work week. They're not paying them, you know, they're not giving them consistent hours. And then if you have to pay child support and whatever else, then you might take home $100 a week.
Okay.
You know, so it's
a tough situation.
It's very tough. So you can expand on that.
It is. I mean, we see it so much because in all our communities, we see the effect that Walmart has on our communities. We see the mom and pops that get closed down. You know, we see the mothers that are on government assistance. I mean, there are Walmart employees that are on government assistance. I don't think
there's
any way better to sum it up.
Hello.
Hi, is that Larry?
Yes, it is.
Larry. Okay, hold on. Thanks for getting on. We'll be with you in just a moment. Go ahead, Brother Wilson.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think like I said, that really says a lot to say that they have full time employees that are on, you know, government assistance. And then when you look at how hard it is to become a full time employee and how long that line is, you wonder, you know, how do they even do it on the 20 to 30 hours they're making?
You're right. And
it's
you know, it's so how can we help, you know, again, as organizers?
Mm-hmm. Well, my call is I'm asking for mainly people to go to the website, forrespect.org, leave your email address so that you can get regular updates about what's going on. Anytime you are in a position where you have to go into a Walmart store, ask the employee how they're doing, you know, just try to give them that encouragement because it is difficult for them. But also, you know, you can check out, they have a Facebook page, it's Our WMT. They you know, the website is great. You can follow them on Twitter at For Respect. You can, there's an 800 number, 888-95-RESPECT, that's 888-95-RESPECT. So it's various ways, you know, of getting in contact with someone, but it's just great to be able to just have people that's going in the stores just asking these Walmart associates how they're doing, because that's a question that they don't hear often in a day.
Mm. All right. Any other questions for William before we move on? Well, William, if you like, you're welcome to stay on with us. We do. Thank you.
Please
and
do.
Hopefully we can definitely organize something here at the Pan-African Connection for, you know, forrespect.org, I guess, the Walmart Workers Campaign for Better Working Conditions. We'd love to, you know, help out. So, you know,
thank you for
stay
having
close.
Me, and I do plan to, well, you know, thank you for having me, and I do plan to stay on the call.
Yes.
All right, my brother. Thank you so much.
I wanted to ask
ahead,
you to stay on because the person who's coming up is one that I know has quite a bit to offer in terms of activism, organization, as a journalist. The person I'm talking about is Larry Pinkney, and Larry is on the line now, which is good. Brother Larry.
All right.
Yes.
Good evening. You are with Kweti and Kaleka, who are the regular host of the show. I'm the sort of fill-in guy to give Kweti a break, I guess. Is that what we say, Kweti? A little rest now and then? Let me, first of all, introduce you. We had a conversation the other evening that lasted a few hours, and As you had done when you were telling me about what you found online, I did the same thing, and I could be reading for the next 6 months and think I would just barely scratch the surface. Background-wise, let me give you, give the listeners a little bit. Larry is former Minister of the Interior for the Republic of New Africa. He was a member of the Black Panther Party, and he's the only American who successfully took his case on civil rights, about his civil rights as having had been a political prisoner, to the United Nations and won. Larry is a writer whose work appears in the Black Commentator, which is an online magazine. He's been in the Boston Globe. He's a regular on the Intrepid Report. His work has been in the San Francisco Bayview, Lincoln Zeitung. He's was subject of a recent, a part of a subject of Lifting the Veil, a Scott Noble film that was, that came out in 2011. And I think that we're going to have to get acquainted to get the film so we can show it at the Pan African in Dallas, because I think that it's one of those that, would really be enjoyed and understood, and there's an audience for it. There was also William Mandel's book, Saying No to Power, the autobiography of a 20th century activist and thinker. And it had an intro by one of my favorite historians, both of our favorite historians, I think, Larry, Howard Zinn. And Kaleika had opened with a quote, and I want to add that quote that you used in the last Intrepid Report that you did, which was the 26th of this month, where you quoted Zinn as saying, the memory of oppressed people is one thing that cannot be taken away. And for such people, with such memories, revolt is always an inch below the surface. And the conversation that preceded this one was one that has those rumblings because of the fact that what Walmart is doing is a continued form of oppression. But what I'm going to do is shut up and let you start in and make your opening statement.
Wow. Well, my first of all, I want to thank you so very, very much, my brother. I want to thank you. I want to thank the rest of the wonderful people at the Pan-African Connection, and of course I want to thank the listening audience. It's a pleasure, it's a delight and honor to be on the program this evening. I think that, as we said in the party, all power to the people. The struggle continues. In fact, the struggle is intensifying on all levels, and I have been listening to the program today with respect to Walmart, what's been going on there. Certainly this is something that is absolutely and utterly unacceptable. I just wanted to mention, though, that I have been listening to what the conversation has been, and this indicates to me the need to intensify in this struggle, politically, economically, socially, culturally, etc. So I'm going to shut up and get back to you, brother.
Well, you know, the things that I have such a long list of things that we've, you know, that you've done, because you've got this history that has been great when it comes to your commentary on politics and government. And so let's go to your political views in one case, and let me just cite a few things. You talked about in some of your recent articles, or older articles, you know, the American reality of fascism. Political opportunists. We had a conversation about that the other evening. And also about these political parties where, I think I cited Leonard Jeffries, who said that they're two sides of the same coin, you know, the white supremacist coin. And something that we have to deal with in terms of that. So in light of your writings and how all of this fits into that political sphere, I'd like to, you know, hear you make some commentary on that.
Okay, well, thank you again. You know, the fact is that we are living in a country, a society, if you will, that continues to be, in my humble opinion, one of, if not the most hypocritical, unjust society in the world, on this planet, on Mother Earth. And, you know, I have repeatedly written in various publications, whether it's a Black Commentator or Intrepid Report or any other publication, I'm speaking for myself, not for BC and not for Intrepid Report. I'd simply write for them. But I want to be clear. You know, back in the early 60s, I had the pleasure of meeting Malcolm X, you know, Al-Haj Malik El-Shabazz. And one of the things, and I was very, very young, but very, very aware, very, very conscious, and reading a lot. One of the things that, or I should say the things that I remember from seeing and speaking with Brother Malcolm was his commitment, his intelligence, and his humanity. And today, in 2013, we as a people collectively, first as Black people / African Americans, secondly as just a part of humanity across the board, irrespective of color or culture, we have to exhibit a commitment to the struggle and intelligence to understand who and what we are in the struggle, and we have to exhibit humanity, that is to say, we have to understand what we should be doing as human beings. And the many articles that I have written, from the article The Reality of Fascism, and fascism, let's be clear about this. We do live in a very fascist state or country, if you will. And people, when people hear the word fascist, people's eyes start rolling up and say, oh, this is not fascist, this is America, the land of the free and the home of the brave. And I say, please, give me a break. Get real. Understand. Benito Mussolini, the former Italian fascist dictator, explained what fascism is, and he did it in very simple terms, and he should have known since he was a fascist dictator. He pointed out that fascism is more correctly or appropriately called, or should be called, corporatism, because it's a combination of corporations, corporate domination, and the political state. And that's precisely what we have to the hilt in this country. The corporate hegemony, that is to say, corporate domination and the political state, okay? And so what we have is we have de facto, in fact, de facto fascism, okay? Not to mention the fact that the vast majority of people, particularly people between the ages of 18 and 25, but even older than that, huge amounts of them are in prison, particularly when you're talking about people of color. Black people, as well as other people of color, not to mention poor people in general. But when we're talking about this, we're talking about an extremely de facto fascist state. When we are dealing with the fact that we're living in a country, in a nation that really gets its jollies, its power, its whatever, in terms of dominating and controlling people in this country, it gets that from force, F-O-R-C-E. You step out of line and you are dealt with. That's fascism. That's fascism. The judicial system here in this country is a joke. It's a sick joke. It's a system that is geared towards, once again, it's a system for the rich. It is a system where only the rich can get any semblance of so-called justice, but the vast majority of people are not millionaires or billionaires, and those are the people, we are the people who are in prison. in this, I call it the gulag system, a prison gulag system. So, I mean, we need to...
I want
to
jump
brother.
In, because you have a history, having had been a political prisoner, that I think, that you might elaborate a bit on, because it will help the readers understand, or rather the listeners understand, as well as your readers, you know, exactly where you're coming from. Tell us a bit about your experience as a political, prisoner, and with COINTELPRO. We talked about that the other evening, and it was something that I just did not want to let, not get mentioned tonight. And I think that your story is one that the folks should hear. So please tell us a bit about that experience and how that impacted your feelings now and your view, because as we discuss, I've had heat as a cartoonist, talking about the Tea Party and how the Tea Party looks like the National Socialist Party of the 30s, which led to the Nazis. And so, we've seen this, and this undercurrent has been here. We're both, I'm a child of the 50s and 60s, and was involved in that. And we saw how the government was our enemy. And you've had it even to a greater extreme. So would you speak on that?
Absolutely. The fact is, yes, you're quite correct. I was a political prisoner. I was in prison for 10 years, and was in prison as a direct result of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program. COINTELPRO being a program that was set up to frame, to discredit, to imprison, and in many, many cases to kill, to murder, political activists. Whether they're black, white, brown, or anything.
To neutralize Larry Pinkley.
yes. In fact, in my particular case, the government, and if anybody wants to check this out, they can read a book, titled Saying No to Power by William Mandel, introduction by Howard Zinn. Just go to that book, and I believe it's on, from pages 500 to 504 or 505, et cetera, and it goes into some detail about it. But the federal government in my file says quite clearly that they were going to, quote, neutralize me, to set me up and neutralize me. No ifs, ands, and buts about it, no playing around with words. They're very clear about that. Because of my political activities, I think we need to understand that COINTELPRO is continuing. It never stopped. I don't care what name we want to call it, whether we call it the Patriot Act, the NDAA, Provision 1021, whether we call it, we can call it all kinds of things. It's been codified in the Patriot Act. It's been codified in the NDAA. But COINTELPRO is real. People are set up, and particularly outspoken people, political activists, organizers, etc. People are set up every single day in this country, this land of the slave and the home of the so-called land of the free, but we know it's the land of the slave. And we have to understand that irrespective to the outrages that this government on the local, on the state, on the federal level engages in, our objective, our job is to intensify in this struggle. It's again to intensify. Too many people, period, but especially in particular right now I'm talking about black Americans, African Americans, black Americans do not know our history. For example, if you say J.A. Rogers or John Henry Clark or Chancellor Williams or Carter G. Woodson or Amilcar Cabral or Walter Rodney, to name a few, they don't have a clue as to who we're talking about. Who, what?
You get blank stares.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. You get blank stares. People look at you as if you just landed on some kind of UFO from the moon or some other planet. And the fact is that we need need to understand our history in order to understand the present, what is going on right now in the year 2013. We need to be aware of what these brothers and sisters have been warning us about, writing to us about. You know, I often think about Carter G. Woodson in his book, The Miseducation of the Negro. My God, you look around today and you see some miseducated, I call them Negroidians, you truly see some serious miseducated Negroidians who don't know what time it is, where they are, what they're a part of, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and this is very, you know, very important that we understand that we are in a situation where we're not being, it's not just our backs against the wall anymore. We are literally being plastered into the wall. I think about the conversation that was going on before I came onto the program with respect to Walmart. Walmart is one of many, many corporations that engages in a 21st century form of slavery. Let's be real. That's what it is. It's a 21st century form of slavery. And there are many other corporations, in fact, the vast majority, that do this. They just do it in varying degrees. And we need to be awake to this and understand that this is a continuation of really basically us being on the plantations. Now, they may not call it. Is irrelevant. We know what it is, and I'm sorry, and perhaps I digressed a bit. But getting back to the counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO and prison. Look at all the murders that go on. The murders, particularly of young black people, and I'm talking about physical. This is I'm not talking about something that behind the scenes or even a setup. I'm talking about the police murders of our youngsters, our young people between especially the ages of 18 and 25. And this happens even as we're speaking right now. There are black people who are being murdered all over this country. And, of course, it will be called justifiable homicide. Justifiable homicide. Well, the police did it because he thought you were going to. You know, this is insane.
He pulled out that cell phone and was going to shoot me with you.
Hey, that's right. That's right. You know, that's why I shot him 52 times. That's why I shot her 21 times. That's why, you know. So this is real. We have to stop hiding behind this illusion that so many of us, unfortunately, have been doing. It's time to break that illusion. It's time to stop chasing the ghosts, as Jameel Al-Amin, H. Rep. Brown, used to say all the time. You know, stop going for the ghosts. We better stop going for the ghosts. And this is 2013, my brother. Back in the 1980s, people between the age, particularly black people, not only black people, but I'm honing in this case on African Americans, between the ages of 18 and 21 had a vocabulary of approximately 25,000 words, okay? Which was so-so. It wasn't great, but it was so-so. Now, in the year 2013, our youth between the ages of 18 and 21 have a vocabulary of less than 12,000 words. What is this?
Mm-hmm.
This, okay, let's get real. This, we're talking about not only a physical genocide, but we're talking about an intellectual and cultural genocide. You know,
So
I'll keep quiet, my brother, and turn it back over to you.
I was just gonna just thank the brother again for joining us, and you know, you're speaking.
Hello? Equator?
Yeah, I don't know if that was my phone or what, but the challenge is that you talked about a lot of our people really chasing the ghost. We don't realize, not we, but many, you know, our biggest problem is in the ideological realm. We don't understand the system, you know, that's creating all of these problems, right? A lot of us, we want to blame the
the workers, right? We want to blame the victim. We want to blame that one that's trying to fight their way out of the darkness instead of those that created the darkness. And some of us, as you said, were just happy slaves. So, you know, I like, you know, you mentioned all of these conditions. You know, it's no mistake that America has the largest prison population in the world, and most of them are poor working people, poor, and particularly poor African people, and, you know, poor people in general. It's not by design. I mean, it is by design. It's no mistake that, you know, we have a uneducated class of people. Of course, you know, capitalism needs that. Go ahead, brother.
One of the things that, and I have to cite a Kwedi for this, Larry, that the Pan-African connection is important for in the Dallas area, for example, is the fact that education goes on there in a variety of different ways for adults, for kids. Education and the raising of cultural awareness, you know, education that's tied to culture. Dr. Clark used to talk about, you know, that clock, that time clock that we had to operate on. And the time we're dealing with is now, but the time that we're working on is not for those of us in our 60s or some of us who are going into our 70s, but the youngsters, the ones that we have to share our experience, our talent with, and encouragement, you know, because these kids go to school and we talk about education and they get canned. And it's one of the words that's not in the vocabulary that I think we should give to our kids. And we can't indoctrinate them into a culture that also works against them. So the understanding and of our history, again, you know, underscoring what you said earlier, the understanding of the anteriority of our culture on this planet is important so that no one else defines us. We define us.
Right. Absolutely. And that defining process is fundamentally the most important component. I would submit is the most important component of our lives. I go back to, as a young person, I was an adolescent when I met Brother Malcolm X, you know, Al-Haj Malik El-Shabazz. Nevertheless, it occurred to me only years later, it occurred to me that fundamentally what Brother Malcolm said to me and with his words and his actions, quite frankly, made an impression upon me. And I'm just using myself as an example to underscore what you just said. The defining process. I was part of a defining process. And we all have to be, all of us sisters and brothers have to be Malcolms. We all have to be Jamil al-Amins. We all have to be Kwame Nkrumahs. We all have to be Sekou Torres. We all have to be John Browns. We have to, you know, because that's a part of the defining process. Again, to underscore what you said, my brother, and the education, of course, that's presented in this country is, of course, not an education at all. It is a miseducation. It is a brainwashing. While we have our sisters and brothers running around here talking and thinking, you know, like they're Wally Cleaver on the Leave It to Beaver show. You know, it's like, excuse me, but you know, meanwhile, they are, you know, being murdered in a very real sense. They are being imprisoned. Their minds are being absolutely obliterated. And we have, the obligation is upon all of us to pass, first of all, to make sure that our younger brothers and sisters, our younger sisters and brothers are wide awake and understanding what they are dealing with, because what they are dealing with is genocide. I'm gonna put it, I'm very clear about that.
Right.
It's genocide.
Yes.
And we have to understand that this genocide comes in various forms and in various degrees, but it is nothing less than genocide. And we cannot expect the genocidor to stop committing genocide. We, the people who are being genocided, culturally, politically, economically, socially, etc., we are the ones who have to put a stop to it. But how can we put a stop to it if we're not even aware that it's going on, that it's happening?
On, right.
You know,
yes.
So once again, my brother, I'll shut up, Chuck, and go back to you.
Collector, did you have a question, or Brother William?
Two questions for Brother Pickney. The first question is, when you presented your case and you won, you know, I don't know how many years that you were confined, but when you did present your case and you won, were you granted any reparations for that, or having served that time? And the other question that I have, go ahead.
No, I'll listen to you. Go ahead, sister, I'm sorry.
And the second question I have is, I know the prison is an industrial complex, and a lot of the labor that goes into the prison and comes out, you know, they have, like, contracts with, like, different companies and corporations and so forth. What happens in these instances where you as an inmate resist going to work? Is there any consequences to that if you say, I don't want to serve your interest, I don't want to go and do this work? Is there how do they deal with that?
Let me interject real quick,
Brother Pickney. We, sure. At one point, I worked with some group of organizers who were helping the prisoners to organize as workers, because that's what they are. They're incarcerated workers. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, so it really should be a part of, you know, and I think some organized unions have a problem with that, but they should be part as a labor union too, as incarcerated workers. They should be organized just as any other workers are organized. But go ahead, brother.
Well, I totally agree with you. Absolutely correct. Because, you know, I use the word slaves. And slavery, you know, slavery is slavery. And the prison industrial complex is, of course, a huge, huge component of the slavery in this country. Anyway, sister, to answer the other sister's question, once I received the United Nations ruling, and let me be clear about the ruling or the factors surrounding the ruling. I am the only quote-unquote American, so-called American, to have ever self-authored. In other words, I didn't use a lawyer. I told the lawyers to get out of my face, basically. And most of them said, you have to be crazy. You're taking your case to the United Nations. Do you think they're going to pay any attention to you? Oh, they won't even accept it, much less rule in your favor. Well, of course, they did accept it. And ultimately, it took about 5 years, all of which time I was in prison. But ultimately, they did rule that I had my human, civil, and political rights had been violated. So I self-authored it, okay? Now, to answer the sister's question, did I get any reparations? My reply is, are you kidding? No, no. As a matter of fact, most people today, even though that case is in many, many books, if you go on my archives, as I'm sure Brother Chuck has done, you'll see many, many books cited where that my case is in. But there again, our people don't know anything about people in general, our people, humanity,
right.
Particularly in this country. They don't know anything about it, okay? So I'm just being very honest, very direct, very blunt to answer your question. Now, as far as the second part of your question goes, or the answer to that, is that we, those of us who are in prison, when we organize, okay, we have to expect consequences, just like as Malcolm said, we're all in prison. It's just a matter of degrees. But those of us who are behind the walls, behind the guard towers, etc., okay, when I organized in prison, in fact, of the 10 years that I spent in prison, I would say that half or well over half of that time I spent in solitary confinement. And the reason was because the charge that was always brought against me was, quote, for the good order of the institution. Now check that out. What does that mean? It means anything
meant,
and everything.
That meant keep them in line and keep him out of there where he can be an influence that's negative to our interest.
Exactly. Exactly, Brother Chuck. Exactly. So, you know, every time they would, when they would release me from solitary confinement, well, what would I do? Well, I would go back in general population and start organizing. I'd be saying to the brothers, like, look, you know what? You have a right to have a phone call. So what, you're in prison? You have a right to get mail. You have a right to have decent food. You have a right to, and of course the brothers would go, yeah, you're right. Why should, you have a right to all these things. We're not talking about no civil rights. No, we're talking about your human rights. And so, of course, what would happen? Why, they put me right back in solitary confinement. But, you know, par for the course, as it were. But that's what the struggle is all about, you know.
In the case of being made stronger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The adversity, right, you know, for you know, you sometimes I think it's like what we miss in terms of having survived the adversity of the abuse of having lived in this country or having been brought here and put through as a culture, you know, the destruction of culture, the destruction of language, the destruction of history as best they could, and these things have turned around. You know, I was going to mention we had a. In the conversation we had a few days ago, we were talking about reading, and you made me think of something when you were talking about the corporatocracy. Mm-hmm. There's a writer that I recommend to a lot of people. Too few have read her. She's no longer with us, but her name was Octavia Butler. Do you remember Octavia Butler?
Yes.
Two books, The Parable of the Sower, Parable of the Talents, where she talks about a corporate slave state. She's going into the future. She has the weight of what Orwell and Huxley and the other writers did when they looked at these things. Only she, Octavia Butler, for those who don't know, is black or was black.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know, she was of African descent and proud of it.
I know that's
and
right.
She infused her work with that ethos. And when her work, you know, when you read her, though she's writing what is ostensibly fiction, you could see how she built that. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
how, if you look at Orwell, how he built 1984 from the work that he did down and out in Paris and London, Borneo, Burmese days, things like that, so that mm-hmm. you understand the history behind it. And what we're talking about is something that this young lady, because she died at a young age, was writing 15, 20, 25 years ago when she was starting out and going to that. And we see it now. You know, you know, it's almost as if she was a prophet. We have too many people who have been doing it, seeing it, saying it, and being ignored by the people who need to read the most.
Go ahead, Chuck. I'm sorry.
Go on a quickie.
I just want to sort of comment. We have, you know, nowadays we have so many scholars. We have so many speakers, you know, we have who have so many wonderful things to say and encouraging things to say, inspiring things, but many of them are lacking the experience, the practice, right? There's a big gap of sacral terrace. It's a gulf between theory and practice, not just a gap, but a gulf. So, you know, I guess for me, we hear a lot of just everybody's on the speaking circuit, right? Everybody's, you know, but many of them have no experience. They're just on the battlefield, right? They're writing about what they've read. They're writing about what others have said. But they're not giving, you know, and a lot of our youth, a lot of people in general, are just waiting for someone to come, give them a quick feel-good session, and move on. Can you kind of speak to that?
Well, you know, I'm so glad you said that, and because in a way what you've done is you've given me permission to say what I'm about to say right now. I am sick and tired of intellectual masturbators, okay? I am sick and tired of them. All right? The reality is that there are so many folks running around here on the plantation, all these different plantations, and that's what they are. It's a plantation. Running around talking about this, talking about that, but they have no clue as to what the battle, the struggle, if you will, is really all about. You know, there's I'm gonna cite a biblical I'm gonna do a biblical quote, James chapter 2 verse 26, okay? And I'm not a quote unquote religious person, I'm a spiritual person, so I don't want anybody to get confused by that. But I wanna use this biblical quote to make a point. James chapter 2 verse 26 says, faith without works is dead. Okay? And we have all these intellectual masturbators running around here talking about this, and as you said, my sister, on the speaking circuit. Oh yeah, they got to speak about this and speak about that, but, you know, I always say, well, brother, sister, could you keep it real for me? Or could you make it real? You know, that album that came out many, many years ago, where the brother, y'all know what I'm talking about, where the brother said, try to make it real compared to what? You know, this is what I think we need to understand. Our youth in particular are looking for and needing, are in need of, our brothers and sisters who are going to keep it real and make it real. They don't want to hear no intellectual masturbators running around here talking all this, intellectual nonsense that really doesn't compute with them. Our sisters and brothers, our brothers and sisters, know the truth when they hear it. They, you know, we all do. We know the truth when we hear it. It's almost kind of an innate thing. So quite frankly, I'm sick and tired of these Negroidians out here who take advantage of our brothers and sisters. I'm sick and tired of seeing the pain of people being pimped, because that's what's happening. You know, people get up there and they go, I have a master's degree, I have a PhD, I have a triple PhD. Yeah, but your PhD is in stupidity. You know what I'm saying? Your PhD is in how to keep a slave happy. Your PhD is not a PhD in revolution. Your PhD is not a PhD in struggle. You know what I'm saying?
I agree. It's just that, you know, we have to, you know, as you said earlier, you know, we have to take on the, you know, and Krumah says, you know, we need a new man and woman, right? One with integrity, one with strength, one who detests greed, right? You know, so we need that type of man and woman today. You know, I own a bookstore, and of course everybody and their mama writing a book. But that ain't saying nothing. So we have to, as we've always done, you know, we have to organize ourselves. We need to create, our people need a political party, a revolutionary political party. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're just spinning our wheels, thinking we can survive in America. But as you said earlier, we must take on the attributes, or really take the baton of those like Cabral, Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, Malcolm. You know, we cannot just, you know, lay down our hands and say, well, we're just going to survive in America. No, that ain't going to get it. I mean, that is not the answer. So, that's you know, I appreciate what you've said this evening.
I've got to drop this in before we get away, because we laughed so much together in the conversation we had, that today I was looking at a poem that you wrote, That Left Has Left. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
At the time, you know, we talked about my old friendship with Jamil from, you know, well, we were boyhood friends and college buddies mm-hmm. and things. But I happened to be listening to a song written by a tennis-playing friend, well, played by a tennis-playing friend, written by another friend that I became a friend through an interview that I did, Gene McDaniels. Mm. And that when you said it, the first line, lie to love, came out. Mm. Hanging on, we push and shove. Possession mm-hmm. is motivation. That's, you know.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Eugene McDaniels, Left Reverend McD, as they used to call him back in the day. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he was a songwriter who, for all of the great stuff that he did, had his eye on what was going on and was writing social commentary. And he was one of those that, except with the exception of Roberta Flack and Les McCann, who did cut that, made comments that disturbed people. You know, it's what mm-hmm. I try to do when we were talking about the fact that I try to make people laugh, but political cartoonists aren't just about laughs. It's about making people think, stop. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, you don't want ennui. You want reaction, negative, positive, whatever, but you want reaction. And the way to get change is to be catalytic, make a reaction, mm-hmm. create one. And, you know, I hate the fact that once we get going, we just don't have the time. My wife asked me to ask you one question. She wants to know, who is your favorite author?
Wow. Me, brother?
Who is my favorite?
Oh, my yeah. God, that is so... I'm sitting here...
You got a long list.
Yeah, I'm looking at about 40 books right now that I'm looking at. Oh, Lord. You know, who is my favorite? Oh, I don't know if I have a favorite author. I can say that as a child.
Five.
Oh, five? That thank you so much. Okay, that makes it a little bit easier. Not all that much, but a little bit easier. Well, I would have to begin with J.A. Rogers. I adore J.A. Rogers. I'd have to say that, and these are people that I read as a youth, and I still go back and reread their writings at least once or twice every year. Then of course there's Chancellor Williams, Dr. Williams,
mm-hmm.
The Destruction of Black Civilization.
Right.
I Quiet as is Kept. I also love Baldwin. Particularly their Fire Next Time. I really love James Baldwin's writings, particularly that book. Richard Wright, etc. That goes without saying. More in terms of our times now. I look at the writings of Asata Shakur. She has a book called Asata, and I pay a great deal of, attention to that. I think about, the writings of Robert F. Williams. And then of course, not just black writers or African writers.
Right. Well, we got Howard Zinn out there.
Howard Zinn is one of my absolute all-time favorite writers. And then there's a younger sister who I believe is only in her 30s. Who is hella writer, as we would say back when I was in California, and this sister's name is Alondra Nelson, A-L-O-N-D-R-A, Alondra, and her last name is Nelson. This sister's deep. She heavy. She's for real. And I hope sister forgives me for saying this. She's a youngster compared to us, but she got it going on. And those are just some, and I just repeat some. I mean, I read like most people eat. I devour, and then I go back and reread. You know, because reading is, as far as I'm concerned, extremely important, as Brother Malcolm said. You put me in a library, you can shut the door, because all I need is water. I got the food.
Yes.
Let me see. Yeah. Anyone else join us that had a question before we have to? Anyone else have any questions? Or Kaleika,
well,
anyone else?
I realize we've gotten that close. We do have that announcement. I'll be at Pan African Saturday afternoon for mm-hmm. the usual activity, teaching the kids and some parents who may be interested some things about art. This week is going to be answering questions about art. You know, we do it as a form of synesthesia, because art is not just drawing the pictures, but it's understanding the music, knowing the history, reading, writing, and doing all of those things that are about creativity, which is what we are about, need to do. So this Saturday, I'll be there at 2 o'clock, and Larry, this conversation
yes.
is going to continue. This conversation is going to continue. We already decided that.
That's true.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, brother.
Yeah,
I want
thanks to, if he's listening to Peter Gamble for saying, hey, call Larry Pinkney. But no, I've told him, I said, I got to get Peter and Bill Fletcher and you and hopefully Kojo and one or two other folk that I know all on at the same time. And we may just have to tell the folk that it's going to have to be a two-hour show that night, because I know with all these talkers, we get warmed up. I want to let you know, man, I appreciate the fact that we to have a piece of living history here.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yep.
you know,
well,
you are.
I thank you, my brother. I thank you, my sister. I thank the listening audience, Pan-African Connection. Mm-hmm. And I want to, you know, simply end by saying two things. One, that as Paul Robeson said, art is really the tool, the revolutionary tool of the people. That's what art is. And as an artist, we have to be about, whatever form of art we may use. And secondly, I just want to say, as I always say, all power to the people. The struggle continues. La lucha continúa. Or as H. Wright Brown, Jamil Al-Amin used to say back in the day, and I still say today, La cima tushende mbile shaka. You know, we shall succeed without a doubt.
Yes.
That's right. Thank you. Kaleika, are you still with us?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyone else? Did I hear someone else? All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and... we're going to go ahead and close it out, and we thank you again. We thank everyone for listening. And as we say, you know, Africans, get organized. And we'll see you next Tuesday. Thank you.
Thank you. Inform the populace.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for a good evening. I'm glad the conversation went great, Larry. I enjoyed it.
Wonderful.
I hope the audience enjoyed it. And there will be more.
Great, great.
All right, everyone. Good night. Thank you. Good night. Forward.